Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show and the Total Education Network, powered by the Simply G Media Network. Remember to go to simplyg.com, go to totaltutor.net, Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. And anytime I bring back a wrestler, it's so much fun to talk to them because I have so much knowledge being an independent professional wrestler for 9 years, and you still have wrestling in your blood. And the guys I talked to from TNA already, and talked to Diamond Dallas Page and all these different people, it kind of gives me, hey, do I want to make another comeback? Then my wife says, absolutely not. But I want to welcome the program celebrity, WWE superstar, WCW superstar, TNA superstar, Al Snow, ECW, all the different things. Al, thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me on. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you because, again, it's kind of funny. When I was being trained in Ohio, you were an independent wrestler in Ohio at that time. And so I was getting trained by Charlie Fulton, and you were breaking in the business in ways that you were doing a lot of independent scene, but you didn't have your big break yet. So I wanted to go specifically enough. Did you always want to be a professional wrestler in your whole life?
Yeah,
growing up?
I always wanted to be, never wanted to be anything else. I just had made the decision that that was what I was going to do. And at the time that I broke in, it was 1982, it was easier to be a made man in the mafia than it was to get in the wrestling business. And, you know, it was very, very difficult to get in, but I knew that was absolutely what I had to do, that I wanted to do, and kept at it.
And at that time when you were wrestling, it's a lot different, much different than today, for sure, in the way that there are a lot of the territories were slowly but surely disappearing. It wasn't a monopoly at that point, but to break into the business, it wasn't as easy as today. You could get trained right down the street. That's not like that.
Yeah, which is unfortunate that, you know, you can get trained right down the street. It was very, very secular, very closed business, very tough to get in, very protected, and like you said, now you can just get trained right down the street, so it's very pedestrian, very commonplace.
And that helps you in a lot of ways because you learned the business and understood the business, and you were old school. You understood different things, and you understood about paying your dues. And I think that seeing these young guys growing up and thinking that, you know, they could come in and they think, hey, I'm going to be the next superstar, they have no idea the whole process and situation. So, Al, what would you say, after you were trained to be a pro wrestler, you started working indies. I was looking at your history, and it was very interesting to see the parallel. When I was working in Burt Prentice's territory, you were finishing up deals and getting ready to go to ECW. So you had an interesting ride, in a way, of going from Smoky Mountain to ECW, back and forth in different ways, and nothing, but you weren't getting your break yet. You were basically paying your dues in a lot of ways, but ultimately also developing your craft a lot of ways, right?
Yeah, I had started in the territories, and then, you know, like you said, they started to dissolve and go away because Vince McMahon had hired away all the workers, the talented wrestlers. He had taken all of them to WWE, or at the time, WWF. And so Jerry Swartz started to fade away. And, you know, that's not the first time that it's happened within the wrestling business. I mean, that had happened once before where, you know, they had had territories and then it became a nationally promoted business from, you know, centrally located in Chicago, actually, because at the International Amphitheater, because that was the birthplace of television wrestling. And then they quickly, you know, eventually went back to becoming segregated territories again. And, you know, it again developed and created into a national promotion, and those territories faded out and faded away just as I was kind of really starting to get started. So you had to go, at that time they were called Outlaws, not Independents, and you had to go and, you know, work the outlaw company to keep yourself, you know, busy and making a living. And, you know, I was known as the best kept secret in wrestling for about, you know, 12, 13 years, which is awesome. It's a great compliment for, you know, a year. And then after a while, you want people to start telling the secret. So, you know, I spent a lot of time learning, and actually it was very valuable. It was, you know, I try to explain to everybody all the time that you can have knowledge, but you never really have a true understanding of what it is you need to do until you have the experience. That's what makes the difference. That's what makes it, you know, that's why doctors go to medical school for 7-8 years, and then they have to spend, you know, another 2 to 3 years in residency, being supervised by another doctor until they get enough experience on their own to now comprehend the knowledge that they've learned. Because without that experience to make that connection, they're not really a true doctor. And the same goes with wrestling or anything else. And, you know, that experience was invaluable, you know. It worked out to help me out a lot.
Did it hurt you in a lot of ways?
It gave me a very long career.
Absolutely. But when you talked about you were the best-kept secret, you were doing the weekend deal, you were doing the Thursday night deals, as you said, in the Outlaws, going from town to town, working, you know, being a champion in one place to teaching somebody the craft to become better as a worker in another place. And then basically, do you think the development of Smoky Mountain and ECW, that was really where finally you were discovered? And I think that the whole mantra of fans becoming more and more smartened up to the business, they kind of dictated.
That's not.
It's true. I agree. I completely agree with that. Al is a former worker. I agree. But meaning that a lot of times they had a lot of the push of the fans developing, saying, this guy's such a great worker, we got to see find somewhere to do it. And then the mark sheets and all the different deals, that helped you in a lot of ways, that PR, to say, okay, Al needs to get his big break. And I think
he did, but the real thing that really helped me was Jim Ross was finally able to see me and interact with me and work with me via Smoky Mountain. And that made all the difference. You know, that was what allowed me the opportunity to go to WWF, to have that opportunity to open the door to get in. Was because of, you know, finally working on a stage where other people could see me and show that I knew what I could do and that I could be a draw.
Exactly, and you got those opportunities in Smoky Mountain and then went to the WWF. And tell us what happened first when you were in the WWF.
I had spent probably, at that time, 13, 14 years as a heel. It's a completely different mindset as a heel, and especially as a heel working in, you know, being brought in just to really kind of, you know, get a baby face over, you know, type of situation. Not a job guy, just being brought in to really get heat, put a baby face over, and, you know, move on. And that was a different situation. And even in Smoky Mountain, I was a heel for the entire run there. And then brought into WWE and was thrust into, and again, this is my responsibility as a performer, thrust into the role of being not only a babyface, but a babyface who carries a mask to the ring, puts it on, and becomes a different persona, and then takes the mask off, which was completely something different. And I know at the time, Vince and I had spoken, you know, he was really trying to capture or captivate and take advantage of the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, which were very popular in Mortal Kombat and all of that at that time. And, you know, the gimmick obviously didn't go anywhere. It didn't evolve. It didn't, you know, I didn't do it the way it should have been done. And so, you know, I kind of floundered for about a year until, you know, they put me in with Marty Jannetty and we became the New Rockers. And, you know, a good 6-8 month run with that. But then again, you know, it kind of ran its course. And due to all my own mistakes and, you know, stuff, it never went any further. And I was back where I started. We were getting very frustrated. And, you know, they were working in conjunction at the time with ECW. And I knew, you know, I had to go someplace else. I had to leave, and I had to go and reinvent myself and get over in terms of wrestling, you know, to become a draw. My career was going to be over. So it was going to be finished. So I went, you know, and luckily, God rest his soul, Chris Candido was a good friend, and he had Paul Heyman's ear, and Paul had Vince's ear, and, you know, one thing like another, and I was basically put on loan to ECW. And I was given another opportunity. So, you know, I went there specifically with the understanding that I had to make myself a draw and did exactly that, thankfully. You know, I was fortunate to find and create you know, the head gimmick that people related to, and was able to capitalize on that and make myself into an attraction.
And I think this was the development, Al, the perfect time to go to ECW, because now the big man in wrestling was kind of disappearing, the muscle bound. They were looking at more guys that could work good in the ring, and that and people that had personality. And you went to a place that the workers really had to be personalities. They had to sell themselves to that crowd at ECW, especially in Philadelphia, and that you had that ability, and now you finally had the stage to perform in it. Would you agree with me on that statement?
That statement pretty much applies to any wrestling organization. I mean, that's really what I've learned through experience, that that's really what it comes down to, is that it's up to you. It's your responsibility. It's not the promotions. And you have to manufacture and create a persona that people can relate to and connect with. And, you know, I just had a discussion earlier today with a young guy who, you know, most of us that are in wrestling are comic book fans, and we fail to realize that when we read comic books like, say, Spider-Man or Iron Man or Superman, you know, Batman, that the majority of the story centers around the alter ego, the secret identity of Clark Kent, of Bruce Wayne, of Peter Parker, Tony Stark. You know, if you read any of these books, you know, the majority of the story is spent dealing with, you know, Peter Parker being the clumsy, goofy, you know, miscreant, you know, the teenager that's never, you know, he's an outsider, he's a nerd. Because people can relate to that person. They can't relate to Spider-Man because they've never clung onto a wall, they've never swung on a web, they've never fought a supervillain. But it takes on so much more meaning when they know that the human being on the inside of the costume is there. And with wrestling, it's the same thing. Before anybody gets into the wrestling ring, nobody's ever, but there are only 8 things physically that we do that anyone in the audience can relate to. And the rest of it, nobody can relate to physically. You know, they think the ring's a trampoline and a mattress. You and I both. That's
not true at all.
That's nowhere near it. But if you talk to a fan, or you talk to a casual fan, which is the most important audience that we have to capture, they think it's a trampoline or a mattress. They don't realize that it hurts every single time you hit that thing, and a lot, you know. So they don't understand the impact or the feel of that big move that you just did because they've never done it. They don't even grasp the fact that when you hit the ropes, it hurts to hit the ropes.
Yeah.
You know, they don't get that because they've never done it. That's why football, baseball, and basketball have huge audiences. It's because everybody has played them as a child. You know, even if you just played it in your backyard or you've played it on your driveway, you played it at the family reunion, you've touched the ball. You physically relate to what you see on the screen. That's why more men have watched sports than women. That's why more women are watching sports now than have before. That's why Canada hockey has a bigger audience, because more people have played hockey than they do in the United States.
Exactly.
It's a very simple process. But with wrestling, it's everything is now centered on the physicality, when really it should be centered on the character and not the physicality. And then that way you can tell a story that the audience can relate to, all about winning and losing, and you can draw an audience. But, and that doesn't change from promotion to promotion. You know, a lot of promotions out there, oh, well, you know, we've reinvented the wheel. This is brand new. No, it's not. It's still, you know, the wheel's still round. Yours is octagonal or hexagonal. You've not come up with anything different. It's, you know, when the pyro ends, the music stops, the bell rings. There's nothing different that you're doing in 2014 that wasn't done in 1914. Done a little faster, done a little bit more, you know, done a little, you know, but then maybe some fancier moves. But really, it comes down to the same thing. It's all about winning and losing. And why do we care? Because we want to be vicariously that guy who's the good guy, and we want to see him overcome the other guy who's the bad guy. That's
so
it.
So true, so, Al. When we get
you,
back, yeah, definitely.
And
Al.
You have to as a performer then make that character that then relates to those people. And you know, and that was for me in ECW, I was lucky to be able to do that, to create that character. Thank God.
And when we get back, and we'll talk about also the push. If they put you in and you're jobbing at the beginning, you're done. You're not going to get, you might get over, but it's a lot more difficult. But if you get the right angle, the right storyline, the right person to work, that creates.
Not necessarily.
Really?
Not necessarily. No, no. That's a big myth, too. You don't have to win to get over. There are tons of guys that have met. You know, look at, I mean, if you want to, an example, Tommy Dreamer never won a match in ECW. And in fact, when I was waiting to try not to win, and he actually got more over because he was not winning. You know, Mikey Whipwreck, you know, was the underdog, never won. He got over. You don't have to win. You don't have to go over to get over. That's a big mistake. And jobbing, that's a word among God knows how many other words that people use these days in the wrestling business that have no clue what it even means. A jobber is not a guy that loses. A jobber was a guy who was not part of the territory, who was not put on TV. Like, when you put on TV, whether you win or lose, you're put on TV to do some sort of business.
Right.
To either get the other guy over or get heat or, you know, you're there to do something as part of, you know, you're either one of two things in the wrestling business. You're either the thing that draws or you're one of the things that help draw, okay? If you're working the territory, you're one of those two things. Otherwise, you're not in the territory. But a guy that comes in just strictly to come to TV, and he's there just strictly to have a match and just simply put a guy over, let him win, okay? That was known as doing a job because it was just a job. In wrestling, the big myth nowadays is that you get fired. You can't get fired. It's physically impossible to be fired because you never hired. It's a business partnership between the promoter and the wrestler. The promoter puts up the front money, buys the TV time, and allows you to then perform and basically create your own commercial to sell yourself, and then between the two of you create an attraction and a draw that the promoter can then promote and draw an audience, and then you make money together. So it's a partnership. But for a job guy, it's not a partnership because he's not there as a commercial for himself. He's there strictly to do a job. He comes in, he gets paid, he leaves. That's it. It's not an opportunity for him. And that's where the term jobber and to do a job came from. So when you see guys in WWE and you go, oh, that guy's a jobber. He's not. That we don't have jobbers anymore because we don't have a guy that just comes in and just does a job. Every single person that's on TV is being given an opportunity to become an attraction and to be a draw. It doesn't matter if he wins or loses. He can still become an attraction and a draw even if he loses. But for the jobber, that was never the intention. The jobber was there just to perform a job, just to show up, get beat, go away.
Al, and again, especially do you think that's changed in the years from before when you were working the territories? Do you think that?
Yes, because we don't have jobbers now. We don't have that guy that's literally, if you're put under contract, you have to understand that a promoter, everything a promoter does, everything a promoter does is an investment of time and money. You're a promoter, you know?
Right.
Are you going to put time and money in anybody, any amount of time and money in anybody, unless you think that you can eventually make that money back out of them?
No.
Of course not. You wouldn't. So let's take that a little step further, okay? Now, I don't know how much it costs now on Raw to have a 30-second commercial, okay?
Right.
But let's say at one time it was 30. It was, and I know that for a fact, it was $30,000 for 30 seconds, okay? So for 30 seconds of television time, it's going to cost $30,000. Now I'm going to give you a six-minute match on a not just national, but an international television show. Now, do you think it really matters if you win or lose in that commercial? Or do you think it matters if you somehow make people want to tune in and see you again? Understand, here's the real thing. This is your real job.
And that's so true, Al.
How good are you that you can make? Just think about it, Neil. How much does it take for you to want to get up off your couch and pay a minimum of $35 these days, $35 to go see anything, and you're going to get up, go outside in the cold, and you're going to drive to a building that's crowded with a bunch of people you don't want to be around and sit in an uncomfortable chair for 2.5 hours to watch this guy.
It's got to be something that entertains you. If it's not entertaining, why get off your couch?
Right. But all of those really cool moves are what's going to motivate people to jump up and get off their couch and go pay to see it. But they don't even know how they feel.
Right. So it's got to be the entertainment side of things and entertain. And how would you say you were able to do it in a character different than a lot of people in certain aspects, especially talking to them when your biggest run, would you say that specifically when the character was the most over, you just really knew your audience. You really knew how to entertain. And that's the key thing about sports entertainment. It's professional wrestling, but also you have to be an entertainer. You have to make it interesting. You have to keep the crowd interested throughout, or else you're not going to get over and you're not going to stay, plain and simple.
True. And it has to be something inside you. You have to, for me, it was that frustration, that feeling like I was going to have a nervous breakdown. Because I was so literally frustrated after years of trying, never really hitting that home run, and telling myself that it was because they never really let me up to bat. When the honest truth was, they were constantly putting me up there with a bat in my hand, and I either struck out or were hitting singles, doubles, sometimes a triple, but I never hit a home run because I wasn't doing the right things. Me as a talent was not doing the right things, not them, me. And I would tell myself, well, it's because I'm not getting the push. It's because I'm not this. I'm not that. I'm not with the right guy. I'm not in an angle. I'm not in the right storyline. But really, it came down to, I've got the bat in my hand. The ball is being pitched, and I need to hit the ball. That's it.
Yeah. I remember at times where I wasn't the main attraction. I was a big guy, but I would go in there and get the crowd so angry at me, they would come to see me even though I was not the main event. And independence. So I understand completely what you're talking about. Where I knew how to get the crowd. The crowd hated me so much, they came to see me, and we were the draw, and we weren't the main eventers because we knew how to entertain. Sure. And that's the key component of this is you have an opportunity in wrestling. You just got to take it. So what made you kind of change that persona? What kind of gave you that mindset? I need to make that change because we definitely can tell you're a very intelligent person now. That you saw that, you know, everything you tried didn't work. You were just trying to be a worker. You saw, hey, this and that. Now I'm going to turn this switch and create this persona that people always want to pay to see.
I just knew, because I had been smartened up when I got in the business, taught and all the stuff that I'm talking about, I was basically kind of more or less explained to me, over time when I first got in. And I kind of lost it and forgot it because I wasn't surrounded with it. And I kind of got lost in TV, changing focus from trying to be the thing or one of the things to sell tickets and, hey, I'm going to be a good worker, meaning I'm going to do a lot of moves, I'm going to do them really well. That's great, but that doesn't make you a good worker. That makes you a great athlete.
Right.
A terrific performer. But great athletics and terrific performance doesn't draw money. Being a great worker in the sense of I'm going to make you believe something that's not real. What's the only thing that's fake in wrestling? There's only one thing that's fake in wrestling. It's the only thing that's ever been fake in wrestling, and it's the same thing that was fake in 1914. It's the same thing that's fake now in 2014. It never has changed. And that's the idea that we're out there actually competing, and we're trying to win and not lose.
That's it, yeah.
That's been lost.
Exactly. Everything else... This again, people they think, oh, you really hit with a real chair in your head? Yes. Did you really?
But they don't know.
They don't know. Exactly. They don't know.
They don't know. They don't know what it feels like. But you hit somebody with a chair to beat the guy. Now that matters. And if you are a persona, a personality, a character that they can relate to, and they can understand that you were a prick for using the chair to try to beat the guy, well, now they're angry. And they're angry enough to where the guy that they like and they want to be, they'll now pay money to see him get revenge on you.
Absolutely. And I think people like the good guy, like the storylines. And it's great that you made that analogy about cartoons. I mean, superhero versus the villain. They want to see good versus evil. They want to see someone to cheer for and root against for. And they also, people who get the most heat, that are hated the most, at one point, people love them. And that's where the turn has to come in so many aspects.
Sure.
And psychology, Al, that's why you were successful. You had the psychology of the business. You understood the business. And a lot of these guys nowadays, which you talk about, they get trained two doors down from my house, and then they may use a mattress to get trained and think, hey, I'm ready to do my first match. They have no idea what it takes to be a professional wrestler. And you've gone through...
Well, and that's just, they're just not being smart enough. You know, they're being taught, hey, it's all about, you know, you got to take these bumps and you got to do these moves and you got to do this formulaic seven-step match that, you know, and then that makes you a good worker. And that can be further from the truth. I mean, it's such a departure from what Charlie, I'm sure, taught you and what, you know, I was taught when I first broke in. It's such a departure. And ultimately, and it's sad, but it is leading to the death of an art form. Probably the only, other than jazz, the only real American art form. It's going to die. It's taking years, but it's on its way out. It's slowly fading away.
And being involved behind the scenes still in wrestling, in a lot of ways, is it just really difficult to talk to some of the young guys, or is that something that you really see as a mission for yourself to smarten them up and teach them the business the way you were taught back in the day?
It's tough, you know. A lot of the young guys do listen, and to me, I'm very fortunate. You know, they're in TNA. They do. They really want, you know, things to be, you know, they want to succeed, and they want to be the reason that it succeeds. And you know, they do listen. It's just, it's very tough to take a guy who, you know, a lot of these things have become ingrained, have become a habit, have become, you know, the way they've done it for years, and now you come along and go, no, that's wrong, and you've got to now do all this, completely change it, and then, you know, and it's tough to try to get them to understand and see that when they feel like, well, I've been successful, and it's like, you're not what you could be, you know, you're not where you could be so much more.
So true. And then, Al, you take wrestling.
You gotta break out of that.
And then you take, from the end, you went from wrestling to now acting. What's the difference? How is it different, especially being where you weren't a trained actor, to acting in films and different things? What do you see the difference between wrestling and acting in certain aspects?
Very dramatic, you know, and one of the bigger differences, and a lot that I still have to struggle with, is, you know, in wrestling, I was never given a script. It was just, you know, here's the points. You go out there and, you know, now make it happen. Be this character. Live it. Breathe it, you know, and then make sure you get this information across and make it to where people are going to be motivated to pay to see you. You know, here's the story we're telling. In acting, you know, you're given, you know, a definitive script, and you got to kind of adhere to it. And at first, that was difficult for me. And as funny as it may sound, like, I was so conditioned that, you know, two things that were difficult was that I have to make my personality big enough to fill up the 20,000-seat arena. Now I have to bring it in to where it fills up only the camera screen. You know, I got to keep it big and make it strong, but not so strong that it overwhelms, you know, it's bigger than the building. And then having multiple takes. You know, in wrestling, you only get one shot.
Exactly.
And in film, you can you know, keep doing it, and make do different takes. And that was different. The other thing was, you know, understanding that I didn't have to do it in just anywhere from 30 seconds to 2 minutes. I could let it breathe, take as long as I wanted. But the one thing that I do realize that was the same, and it's helped me immensely, is that once I get in front of the camera, it's on me. It's no different than when I walk out to the curtain. It's my opportunity, no matter what the character is, what the role is, if I'm getting shot, if I'm being, you know, I'm going to be the hero, whatever it is, that's my chance to just make it my own. Doesn't matter what, you know, nobody's going to be able to tell me what to do. I got to feel it, and I just got to make it. And it's a chance for me to now sell myself and possibly create a commercial that will then get me more opportunities to do that again.
I interview a lot of actors, and there's such a relationship between wrestling and acting in so many aspects, and I see it all the time because, again, it's about networking, next best opportunity, right place, right time, and making sure you have the best performance possible. Now, Al, do you have any projects you're promoting right now? I know you said you're working for TNA, but is there any films coming out that you want to promote?
Well, there's Money Shot is a comedy that is out on Netflix right now. It's been out for quite some time on Netflix. Overtime, the movie, came out in Walmart last year. They had a re-release in Target. Didn't know it's still on iTunes. Alice D is a horror film with Kane Hodder. That'll be coming out very soon that I just did. Fat Chance, kind of a comedy horror slasher flick. That'll be coming out very soon. Lake Erie, it's a horror film that I just had an opportunity to great movie. And then Piranha Shark, supposed to be out on Sci-Fi Channel very soon. Had a part in that. Hopefully going to be able to get to do another horror film coming up called Mangled. And then I've got a couple others on the burners that, if I get the opportunity, I'll get the chance to do. But I hope that, if anybody wants any more information, they can follow me on Facebook or they can follow me on Twitter at The Real Al Snow. And, yes, I had to put The Real Al Snow because there were some fake ones. And I would write them and go, look, if I were to fake being a celebrity, I would aim higher. I wouldn't want to be me. Something so much more than me, trust me. I'd like to be the George Clooney or, Neil Armstrong or, for God's sakes, anything, but not Al Snow. What are you thinking? Guys, you really set the bar low. You're going to fake something. Fake it. Come on.
Yeah, absolutely. Al, well, I appreciate you coming on the show and educating me on absolutely the business even more and what your persona. I bet you I could debate you, but again, you're the more of the veteran on some of the points, and I didn't want to do that in an interview all about you. But I really agree that you get the stage. It's up to you to make sure that you're great. And it doesn't matter where it is, because one person sees you or hears you, you're on your way to the next level, and that's the key.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're up at bat. You've got the bat in your hand. The ball's being thrown. What can any one person do to help you at that moment?
And that's
what can any one person do to hinder you? Nothing. They can't do anything. And it's the same in acting, in wrestling. You get there. You're up at the plate. There's nothing that no one can do to hold you back. Nothing. It's just you and the bat and the ball. And if you hit a home run, it's on you.
Well, Al, thanks for taking the time. Look forward to talking to you again. Let me know when you're looking to promote any more films or different things, or give us more of your acting deal. But we could talk about so many different things, but everyone needs to follow him. And really a great conversation. I appreciate you taking the time, Al.
Thank you very much, Neil. I really appreciate it.
All right, take care, Al. Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, powered by the Simply G Media Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. SimplyG.com for Simply G Media, because we're on the Simply G Media Network, and I want to welcome the program my co-host, Jarrett. And Jarrett, again, it's kind of funny how I can find people from the University of Pittsburgh, and I don't even meet him in Pittsburgh. Isn't that funny, my stories I always tell you?
It is, and when you told me about this interview coming up, I had to be a part of it, because I remember our guest being a star in high school, college, and moving on to the pros. So this is a very exciting interview for me.
Oh, I'm excited to talk to him as well. I want to welcome the program. Super Bowl champion, former Pitt Panther and NFL player, Darnell Dinkins. Darnell, thanks for calling.
Hey, guys, I want to thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure, and it's great being back in Pittsburgh.
Exactly, and we all talk about Pittsburgh and all these different things, but Darnell, tell us a little bit about your background, and then we'll get right into talking about your camps and why you're back in Pittsburgh.
Well, my background is I was born and raised in the Hill District. Grew up, loving, every sport. Asked me if I was going to be a wrestler. You couldn't tell me anything. I used to make the belts. I used to go out and jump off the fences. We should talk in the mirror, and you know, really set myself up. But I was always a physical kid. Ended up, you know, doing really good in baseball, basketball, and football. Loved just being a quarterback. Ended up being one of the top 100 players in the country and going on to the University of Pittsburgh, where I endured, you know, I never really got a chance to play quarterback the way I desired, but played everything under the bus. Receiver, linebacker, safety, washed clothes, drove the team bus. I did everything down there. But it was a blessing, and I learned a lot. So I ended up playing.
And Neil, and I know we're really focusing in on the and I apologize for interrupting Darnell, but I remember his college career and the respect that I have for Darnell for staying with the program. I can only imagine how many other players would have transferred out. And Darnell stayed with the program. He is telling this exactly the way it happened.
Yeah, and I, you know, I'm a whole no punches, you know, and at the time I was a young recruit. Here you are, one of the tops in the area, and you never get an opportunity really to, you know, pan out. Even when you do, you know, you're in a battle where you injured training camp at 60-some percent. Pete Gonzalez is about 70-some percent and had a great season, but you end up moving positions and not being given enough opportunity. So at the end of it all, it made me a stronger player, helped me deal with adversity, as we are a society nowadays where parents try to fill in the gap so much and don't allow kids to go through things. The things and the hardships I went through on the front end made me a better and stronger player when I got to the NFL and in life.
That's what we love to talk about, Darnell. We bring athletes, especially celebrity athletes, on the show, especially locally from Pittsburgh, which is fantastic, is the fact of about giving back and looking at specifically what you learn in your life and how that takes to life after football. So life after football, you did coach at Rutgers. Now you're back in Pittsburgh, and we talked about, we're going to definitely talk about your camps and everything, but what made you want to come back to your hometown? You could have continued, you know, to look for other coaching positions after Rutgers. What was the idea of saying, I'm going to come back home?
Well, me and my wife, Melissa Dinkins, you know, we were sitting around having a conversation, and my children from my previous marriage, you know, they were, you know, here. They're doing very good in sports. We're raising our own son, Jalen, as well. So it just, you know, fit into helping develop them. So as we came back, my wife kind of, you know, tricked me into, not tricked me, but, you know, saying, you know, Dave, you need to go out and coach the kids, you know, play a football team. They love going out and doing things with you. I did it. We scored about 300-something points in 6 games. Had a color-coded system. There was 2 and 3 coaches on other teams. They were kind of chasing their tails. I got kids in and out of the huddle. They loved it. And it just kind of sparked the interest for being able to help a lot of kids. On the flip side of that, as I was recruiting at Rutgers, I was going into homes and seeing a lot of parents who were crying, their kids were not eligible academically with the recruitment process. There's a lot of things that get thrown on parents that senior year, and a lot of things with core classes, GPA. So I just took all the things that I learned as a player and as a coach, and now I would apply it to a lot of them parents, helping them with the recruitment process, giving them a blueprint and a game plan to get their child not to the top D1 schools, you know, Pitt, Rutgers, West Virginia, but to get to college. And a lot of that, this is about being proactive, so you won't have to be reactive.
I love hearing this, Darnell, especially owning a tutoring and consulting company and seeing how I want to help kids, especially get through that process to get to college and encouraging them to get to college, Jarrett. And it's fantastic to hear that Darnell saw this from coaching at Rutgers and also coming home, that these kids truly need somebody to help them in that process so they're academically eligible, so that they have the opportunities after high school.
Exactly. You know, I tell kids all the time, you know, I can bench press 275 about 20-something times still. So we're running 4 or 5 probably one time before I blow both my hamstrings out, you know. But at the end of the day, the 6 inches between my ears and what I learned can't ever be taken away, you know. And those are the things, the realistic conversations. I'm not trying to be discouraging the kids, but I do encourage them and encourage parents with finding they have set realistic goals for themselves. You know, there's so many parents that don't understand you need 16 core classes to be eligible for Division 1, 2, or 3 sports. I'm recruiting a kid in Jersey. He had about a 2.4. When you take out gym, when you take out the other electives, it dropped his GPA to a 1.9. He couldn't compete in college. So these are realities of recruitment all over. And every parent out there probably tells their kids is the next D1, next Kobe Bryant, next Michael Jordan. But at the end of the day, I call it the KYR factor. You got to know your role. The more you know your role as an athlete, the more you know your role as a, you know, a student, you can pick the right school for yourself and put yourself in a better position to have a better career, a better, you know, future.
We're talking to Darnell Dinkins, and we're learning ultimately about the growth from his career at Pitt to the NFL and coming back and seeing he wants to be that help. He wants to help kids that really need that help, Jarrett, and especially with the camps and stuff, because kids just don't know exactly how important academics are. And Jarrett, we talk about this a lot, don't we?
Absolutely. And there is no better person than Darnell to describe to a parent the rapid changes that can happen between the high school career and the college football career and the success or even the lack of opportunity. I mean, Darnell experienced all of those things within his high school, college, pro career, as he previously discussed. I definitely want to hear more about the camps that he is offering, because I mean, listening to Darnell, I know there's a formula here. I've heard him telling it. Darnell, tell us more about the camps, the formula for success that you provide.
Okay, well, here's the thing, guys. You know, and like I said, holding the camps, kids that come to my camp don't just, you know, go there, they throw a go route, they throw a slant, go home. Me and my wife has put together an extensive, you know, information where I go out and I speak, you know, in high school about the recruiting process. But with the kids that come to our camps, you know, they'll learn information about what comes next. You know, and I reckon we had a board as far as what the D1 receiver looks like, D2, D3. We've taken all that information, we put in our book, you know, as far as what a lacrosse player looks like, what's the minimum requirements. If you want to be a baseball player, right-handed pitcher, you know, you need to be at least 6'1", 180 pounds. Have velocity of, I mean, have an 88 to 90 mile fastball. This be considered at the D1 level. So when kids come to my camp, and they can go, anybody listening right now can go to the website that my wife made, Melissa. She did a tremendous job. It's Epic. I mean, it's Dinkins, EpicTraining.com. Once again, that's Dinkins, D-I-N-K-I-N-S, Epic, D-T-H-I-C, Training, T-R-A-I-N-I-N-G. .com and find out all the things that we do as far as the camps go. Now, when kids come to these camps, they're going to learn the details of the coverages. It's cover one, cover two, how you run a route, how you throw a route against that, running backs, finding the zones. But at the end of the day, they're going to learn about the core classes, their GPA. They're going to learn about NAIA schools. A lot of parents don't understand the difference between Division II, NAIA, Division III. Division III schools recruit a lower-tier type of athlete but don't have any athletic scholarships. NAIA schools are a little more Christian-based but will give you a full athletic scholarship. So those are the difference. And when you start setting realistic goals for yourself, parents can walk away with a lot. So these are the camps I'm having, and not only just to give kids, you know, the techniques and things that cut down on injuries, but to also walk away with information. And we're also opening up to the youth from second grade all the way up to high school. We're going to give 10% back to all of the students, all the youth organizations for kids to come out there. So if I got 100 kids from North Hills that come from the youth league, we're giving 10% of that back to there. So that's $50 for 6 weeks. And that starts March 9th at Pittsburgh Indoor Sports Arena down at PISA.
Wow, that's fantastic. You're not far at all if you're talking about PISA, especially me being in the Gibsonia area. So, yeah, we're definitely I'm going to keep promoting this for sure. And we're going to have you back again to talk about Pitt football some more in certain ways. And what I like, Darnell, hearing about your camp is, again, you're not just teaching technique. You're teaching them to have the opportunities, what they need to do. As I always consult with parents, and I'm talking just not just academic parents that have kids they want to go to college, they have no idea what to do. They have so many questions. And I think, Darnell, that's where I saw that this is a perfect opportunity to get the word out, is that so many parents aren't told at their child's school about how to apply to schools, where to go, what to look at. And especially when it's sports, the coaches are too busy and they just don't have the time to really explain it to kids.
Absolutely. You know, you look at the ratios. In most high schools, the ratio to guidance counselors are usually about 1 to about 300. You know, so there's no way that a guidance counselor can give their information to a kid and help them, you know, both athletically and academically. There's no way an AD can do it. And so a lot of parents, at the end of the day, their kid's senior year is getting upset with the athletic director, with the coach, with the counselors for not putting their child in the right situation. So me and my wife have devised, you know, an opportunity. We go out and give, you know, free seminars. We give kids over CDs with over 1,100 hours of SAT and ACT prep stuff. We give them all the details from financial aid, the FAFSA stuff, and allow people to set a realistic game plan for their child to get to the right school. And so now when kids are in these camps, they're going to learn the academic side, but at the end of the day, they're going to learn the techniques to help cut down on all the concussion issues, all the injury issues. And that's why I want to start with a lot of the youth. The second and third grade kids are going to, you know, have some, the fourth and fifth grade and the sixth, seventh, and eighth. And when they come, they're going to learn the proper techniques and the proper things that help them become better players. As all the ADs I spoke with, the kids that's coming into the high schools don't necessarily have that proper technique. And you never want to take away from the guys who are volunteering their time to coach, but it's about coaching the right way. And now, you know, you add that component, we're helping the counselors, we're helping the coaches in the high schools, and now it's an all-encompassing thing, helping kids learn the proper techniques, helping guidance counselors and ADs and coaches understand that there's more than just the athletics that need to be told, but they need to understand the academic side of things and the compliance things with college. So I'm trying to help full circle, me and my wife, going to help full circle all the kids that are in the Pittsburgh, in the Pennsylvania area, Ohio, West Virginia area, and just allow them to be better students and athletes.
Jarrett, amazing. Amazing what Darnell's trying to do, isn't it?
Absolutely. And again, you know, my question was addressing that formula. And, you know, what I'm hearing is the formula for this kind of success is, you know, so many camps focus only on the skills and the children that are attending those camps. And Darnell and his wife are including those players, but they are including the parents in this because the parents have to be a part of that formula. And I'm equally excited that Darnell just mentioned second graders because my son is in second grader and he has been begging me to let him play football. So I'm definitely going to be checking out his camp.
Well, I want to tell you this. My youngest son, my next youngest son is 9 years old. He wanted to play up with his brother in the flag football league I was coaching for the 10 to 12-year-olds. And when you teach kids proper technique, when you teach them change of direction, when you teach them shoulders over your knees, understanding the game, zone coverages, man, he went out and led the team in catches, touchdowns, interceptions, shook a 12-year-old kid for a touchdown, and he really, you know, excelled without the fear of getting hurt, without staying out there for hour-long practices as a parent. There's nothing wrong with flag football. So if anybody listening right now, you guys, go to PISA, USA, www.pisausa.com. They'll see Essex football on there. They can click on the football icon. You can register today. $50 for six weeks. $50 for 6 weeks. And we're tallying up all the stuff. Starting March 9th, 10% of that money is going back to the youth organization for wherever those kids is from. So if I get 100 kids from Fox Chapel, 50 kids from, you know, Pound Richland, those 10% of that goes to Pound Richland, 10% of that goes to Fox Chapel. So I'm really about trying to help these kids. And so now you add the, you know, other component to that. We're understanding and teaching these kids about the concussion issues and then going to the whole flag football league, which will start on April 27th. So I just really want to teach kids the proper techniques and allow them to have fun because there's too many parents, there's too many people putting all the emphasis on these kids, trying to make them superstars today when they're forgetting technique is key. If they stay with them the rest of their life, but having fun is more important. And I want to just, you know, really just focus on those things, those core values. And that's why me and my wife came up with the word ethic. It's effort, toughness, heart, intensity, commitment. Nothing to do with talent, nothing to do with a vertical, a 40, but really just the basis of all sports.
Well, Darnell, you said it, and I'm telling you, this is such a great thing, and definitely we're going to help promote this, have you back to maybe talk some Pitt football, talk some NFL football next month. I'm so glad we connected on LinkedIn, but I want to commend you for being an educator. That I could just see the difference between, I talked to lots of NFL athletes, former NFL players, but you really are behind what you're doing. You're truly passionate about what you're doing, and you have to be commended for this, because a lot of times they say their name's on the camp, but yet they're not involved in coming up with everything. We could tell, Darnell, you're not just talking points. You truly are behind this 110%, and you're looking to help kids, especially with saying about the concussions and also about making the right choices. So I appreciate you calling and look forward to having you back on next month. So good talking to you, Darnell.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me on. I want to thank you guys for giving me and my wife the opportunity to spread the word to help kids both on the concussion issues, on the injury issues, and ultimately on getting to the right schools. The more you can pump this up, keep pushing ethic. I'm thinkingethictraining.com website and the Pizza USA so people can sign up. The more people to sign up, the more youth organizations we can get back to, the more proper equipment we can give. So you won't see kids out there with a super huge helmet on and really putting themselves in harm's way. So I thank you guys for having me on. It's been a blessing.
All right. Well, take care, Darnell. Good talking to you. Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Absolutely.
All right. You're listening to Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, powered by the Simply G Media Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Total Tutor Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, the Insightful Players series powered by the Simply G Media Network. You can go to SimplyG.com to find out more information. And for the Insightful Players, that's what I'm so excited. Always interview them. Have partnered with NFL players who are great role models to empower youth. The NFL players are featured in a book with even more stories on at insightfulplayer.com, where you can purchase the book. And they also offer valuable educational programs, including school assemblies. And if you're in the Pittsburgh area, you can contact me at 412-523-0289, and we can try to get things going out in the Pittsburgh area. And I want to welcome the program, Insightful Player Rashid Davis, and then I'll go to my co-host after that. Rashid, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fantastic. And Jarrett, you could tell I'm tired. Jarrett, my co-host, you always are exciting interviewing insightful players. You're ready to buckle in for this one, right?
I enjoy every one of the interviews that we've had. And in addition to being insightful, they're informative. And mostly, most important is that they are inspirational.
So this story, honestly, is just an amazing one. We've said this about insightful players. So Rashid, basically, just to set the stage, you grew up in South Central LA, and a tragedy happened to you at a very young age, which made it a definite challenge to survive in South Central. Tell us about that.
Oh, man. I'm one of nine kids. I was born in South Central, like you said, raised there. But my father was killed when I was 8 years old by, a young lost gang member who since is probably out of jail by now. I don't know what has happened since then, but, yeah, that was the first of many tragedies in my life.
Wow. And it's something, when you hear about something like that, to overcome that early. But Jarrett, he's placed in a situation where you look at Rashid and you say, okay, nine children, South Central LA, growing up in a very challenging environment without a father. Jarrett, I know you have some interesting questions after that, right, Jarrett?
Of course I do. And first, let me begin by, I wish I could offer more than I'm sorry for what happened. But at least accept that from us to you. The question I have for you: you're eight when this happens. How did you and your family? How did you pick up the pieces? How did you go on?
It's hard to say when you're eight. You don't really, think about things as deeply, or at least I didn't. I just remember the night I found out. I was raised by my mom and my great aunt Bertha, and my great aunt came into the room, and she said, "I think I know what happened. I think we know what happened with your father. But if I tell you, you can't cry." And of course, I said, "Yeah, I'm not gonna cry. I'm not thinking anything of it." I think. Also, it was my first, brush with death, I guess. My first little instance with someone in your family dying. And she mentioned, that I think your father's dead. And I said, you know, I didn't say anything. I just sort of paused for a second, and I started tearing up. And she said, well, you said you weren't going to cry. And so I kind of sucked it back in a little bit, and that was the first time that I had to deal with death, to my knowledge, and the understanding that, you know, my father wasn't going to be back. And my father wasn't, you know, the nicest man either. My father was a pretty harsh individual. But, you know, it was a tough deal. We just sort of moved on our day on with everything like, mm-hmm. I guess, like everyone else does. You know, we had some help. We did get some help from different programs. I don't remember any of the names of them. But we would get gifts from different police organizations that would bring stuff over for Christmas. And that happened for a few years after his death. We did some counseling for those, you know, victims of those who had family members killed from, you know, gang violence and stuff like that. So, but it just, I was so young, it was just like another day. We just sort of had to keep moving. We were still alive.
To be able to deal with that at that age, but then what happened, Rashid, is based on that environment, you chose people who you met, who you wanted to the model after and to emulate that weren't very good people, right? During that
time. Well, I mean, I think everybody in that time, or as we got older, I won't say exactly around that time, but as we got older, our neighborhood got worse. And, it went from shootings every once in a while to shootings all the time to our house being shot up by, you know, rival gangs because my older brothers were in gangs. And we were sort of the house that people came over and we hung at. You know, everybody in the neighborhood knew our house. Police knew our house as, you know, the spot where things happened and where drugs were being sold. So we just sort of lived in that house, in that environment. So as things escalated, as I got older, like any other kid in that neighborhood, the only people who had anything that we thought was worth having were the drug dealers, the gang members. So you sort of wanted to be a part of that because, you know, you sort of get tired of having the dirty clothes and the pro wings, the not-so-nice shoes, because, yes, you know, everybody's talking about you. They're pretty much bagging on you, and you're, as a kid, you don't quite understand it. You don't know. You know right from wrong, but not so much when you're around that environment and everything that's wrong seems right.
Yes.
You know, and you can't distinguish. You can't filter life through the lens of an educated individual, of a person who lives and knows. You can't filter life through that. You filter life through what you see every day. And what I saw every day was drugs, gangs, violence, you know, and that's why we started our Saturday Place program and stuff like that. But I'm sure we'll get to that later.
Oh, we definitely will. We'll definitely promote that. And we have to remind us in that process of the tremendous story, how you looked at that as your foundation is such an important part of where you're coming from. So, Jarrett, kind of painting that picture as we're talking about, this has got to be such a powerful situation that we talk about on our education portion of the show, Jarrett, every week, that how many kids that come from poverty, come from violence, how they are, it's impossible or very difficult for them to get out, Jarrett.
Well, sure. We talk about the power of education, the power of family, of community, provides alternative paths, you know, and for so many communities, and I think this is what I'm hearing with Rashid, with so many communities, we see one path, and that path is certainly not not the one we necessarily want to follow. And and I like what Rashid mentioned. I've had a chance to read about the Saturday program that he has developed at Foundation. I'm going to ask Rashid if he can share with our listeners. He has this path in front of him. His peer groups are moving towards this direction that we know is not going to be healthy and doesn't have a positive outcome. Rashid, where does it begin to change for you?